I told you about going to the movies in the 1925, in the mid-20s, and getting programs, a way in which the movies began to legitimate themselves as a for real cultural experience. And this is the one that you would have gotten if you'd gone to see Cecil B. DeMille's production of The King of Kings. Jesus plays well with children. We're going to see Jesus give this little girl sight in a minute. Here is Henry B. Warner, the 49-year-old man who plays the 30-year-old Jesus. Jesus as father, really. Here is the spectacular crucifixion scene at the end of this movie, which we are not going to see. This is the high priest Caiaphas. Can you see his headdress well enough to describe it? What does it look like? Ram's horns or devil's horns. In the passion plays of medieval Europe, the high priest wore devil's Satan horns. Now, Cecil B. DeMille had a huge ego, and here is a graphic illustration of that. Here is the director surrounded by some of the men who played the apostles. He is sitting in the place that would be usually accorded who? Jesus. Yes. All right, Cecil. All righty. We are going to now watch parts of two separate DVDs of King of Kings, The King of Kings, that we talked about last time. The first thing we're going to see is the title, and it begins with a little sermon. You should have already read an extended part of this sermon. The little handout we gave you. Cecil B. DeMille said this is explicitly an evangelical and evangelistic project. This is to advance the cause of Jesus in the world. Folks, not even Mel Gibson had the balls to say that at the beginning of The Passion of the Christ. But in 1927, it was still possible to say that and get by with it. So, an explicit statement of the Christian mission, the evangelical mission of the film. Then, this is Cecil B. DeMille, who already is associated in the public mind in the mid-20s with extravagance, spectacle, and sex. Sex sells films. Folks, this life of Jesus begins with sex. It begins with Mary Magdalene, who is often seen in the scriptures as who? Mary Magdalene is often taken to be also the woman taken in adultery, or a prostitute, right? Here she is a courtier. She's a courtesan, a very rich-kept woman. And she's playing around with a bunch of guys. She's very rich, and she is very, very sexy. She's in advanced state of undress. She has a boyfriend. Folks, you just have to follow Dr. Miller on this. She has a boyfriend. His name is Judas. Judas Iscariot is Mary Magdalene's boyfriend. But she hasn't seen him lately because he's been hanging out with a bunch of guys. And she gets angry about that. And she says, I'm going to find that carpenter and tell him what's what. And an old guy says, oh, no, you're not. He's a miracle worker, blah, blah, blah. Watch it. So she finally decides that she's going to go see him, and she calls for her conveyance. It is a chariot, folks. This is the age of the chariot and the chariot race. But folks, you're not going to believe what drives Mary Magdalene's chariot in this spectacle. Not horses, but can you think of a kind of a spectacular looking horse? No, not a unicorn, but remarkably colored horses. Zebras. Here comes the zebras, driven by a man in advanced state of undress. All righty. Sex. And off she goes. Then we're going to see one of the most remarkable films of scenes in all of the cinematic lives of Jesus. The movie has already been going on for about 30 minutes when we see this. We haven't seen Jesus yet. We've seen his back. We haven't seen his face. This is how Cecil B. DeMille shows us the face of Jesus. Other film directors have not wanted you to see it. This is how he shows it. Mary is importuned, asked by a little boy, John Mark, who Jesus had healed, to heal his little friend, his little girlfriend, who is blind. So the mother intercessor, get it? Intercessor takes the little girl to Jesus. We haven't seen Jesus. They're looking at us. I'm Jesus. They're looking at us. And the mother says, "Son, this little one has need of thee." And then she actually bows, prays to Jesus to give her light. Then it all kind of gets kind of fuzzy. We're obviously inside her head, inside her face. And then as this music, this modern music, contemporary music, begins to play, you can see light. And the cinematography does those lens magic again. And slowly, guess who you see? Jesus. The first sight of Jesus is an act of miraculous healing. It is really miraculous film editing. Then we're going to see one of the more remarkable resurrection scenes. Folks, it's hard to do the resurrection without being hokey. You just saw, the hokiest one with elevator Jesus. This one's not bad. And it is glorious color, and all of a sudden we have Easter for days with colors and birds and doves and everything. All righty. Then I'm going to switch out CDs. Now, my laptop is acting up, so I'm trying to switch out DVDs as little as possible. So now we're going to go back and see two more clips. One, we're going to see what happens to Mary Magdalene when she gets to Jesus. We're going to see the exorcism of Mary Magdalene. Again, with remarkable lens work. As the demons come out of Mary Magdalene, watch what happens. And then we're going to see the cutest scene ever in a life of Jesus. Jesus healing something. Is this a feminine Jesus? Is it a masculine Jesus? No, this isn't really a masculine Jesus. Would Bruce Barton like this Jesus? He didn't. No, he didn't like this Jesus. But who is this Jesus? This is a weird Jesus, isn't it? For one thing, he's just too old. He's just too old. But that turned out to be what people loved about it, because he combined God the Son and God the Father. Other comments? Does it bother you when the movies make up things about Jesus? I get used to it. It gets much worse. All righty. We're going to talk for the next two times about Jesus in the era between 1914 and 1945, the era in which Americans underwent two world wars and the Great Depression. The 30 years between 1914 and 1945 constitute one of the most important generations in the history of the Western world. Big statement, but it's true. In our time, we have come to idolize, not idealize, idolize the men, particularly the men who lived in this era and did these great things. What do we call these people now? The greatest generation. This is opposed to us, who, by contrast, are not. In this generation, for the first time, the entire globe was involved simultaneously in epical events. Things happened to everyone all over the globe at the same time because of communications. The Great War of 1914 to 1919 that becomes World War I. The Great Depression, the worldwide Great Depression of the 1930s. And then World War II, culminating in the great mushroom cloud over Hiroshima. This is the generation that produced our world. Because World War II was followed immediately by another war. What war? The Cold War. A 40-year conflict, religious conflict, between the United States and the Soviet Union. This war has ended, and this is the first time I can say this of all of us, this war ended in our time. Our time. And it left the American Republic the world's only superpower for good and for a great deal of ill. Let me begin by giving you a very quick overview of this period. I do not intend to insult your intelligence, but something has to be done. It has to be done quickly. The nations of Europe went to war in 1914 over all sorts of issues. They need not detain us here. The United States kept aloof from the war until 1917. In 1917, the President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, a man who was a rock-ribbed Presbyterian, a very serious Calvinist Christian, and who had been the former president of Princeton and governor of New Jersey, Woodrow Wilson took the nation into the conflict as part of a great crusade to make what? To make the world safe for democracy. From the American perspective, the monarchies of Europe had foolishly stumbled into a war of their own making. And now, the Americans were going to have to clean up the mess they made. The churches of the United States, almost uniformly, universally supported the war. The war effort was seen by many as a way of exerting the muscles of muscular Christianity. Service in the armed forces, it was thought, would encourage in young men discipline and patriotism and selflessness and mostly manliness in America's young men. And they hoped that the World War would put an end to the alarming rise of socialism and communism that seemed everywhere to be gaining strength in Europe. The Allies, of course, won the Great War, World War I, but they won it at horrendous cost. An entire generation of Europe's best young men died in the trenches of World War I. This is the war of great innovation in warfare. Those trenches themselves were an innovation. Trench warfare. Dig in and shoot each other for 6 months, and the battle line changes a mile. Hundreds of thousands of people die. Machine guns, tanks, poison gas, nerve gas. And in 1917, the Bolsheviks overthrew the Tsarist government of Russia. And all of a sudden, it became clear that the World War had made the world safe not for democracy, but for communism. And in the 1920s, the capitalist economy of America boomed spectacularly as it had never had before. What do we call the 20s? The 20s were the what kind of 20s? Roaring 20s. But even in the roaring 20s, a very real sense of disillusionment was setting in America. And many Americans began to turn their backs on Europe. Never again will we go to a world war to make the world safe for anything. They can take care of themselves. The immigration gates were closed. Quotas were set up to make sure that only the right kind of Europeans came. good Northern European Christian stock, not those swarthy people from Southern and Eastern Europe, and especially not Jews. And a wave of isolationism swept over the nation. And this wave of isolationism, as some of you know, was accompanied by a truly astounding and frightening outbreak of organized racism and anti-Catholicism in the United States. We see, for instance, the reemergence of the group that had been founded in the late 19th century to advance white supremacy, the Ku Klux Klan. And we see at state and local and federal governments a crackdown on all who were different, on subversives, the first Red Scare, as we look for communists, socialists everywhere. And then, in October of 1929, came Black Tuesday, and the bottom fell out of the American economy. And the world economy was plunged into the worst depression it had ever seen. Even while the Americans were lashing out at suspected communists and socialists, the capitalist system that they had so revered and preached as the universal cure for all the ills of the world, at home and abroad, that capitalist system failed them utterly. In the United States, the Great Depression and the disillusionment of the war intensified the urge to turn our backs ever more emphatically on the rest of the world and to take care of our own, even as we became suspicious of anyone who wasn't one of us, who is one of our own. The 30s, then, were a period of isolationism and attacks upon minorities and outsiders in the United States. Young people, I assume that most of you know in general terms that, but here is something that maybe you don't know about the Great Depression. The Great Depression introduced a powerful new force into American lives. A force that heretofore had not played much a role in the daily lives of American citizens. What force am I talking about? A force that used not to play much of a role in people's daily lives at all, all of a sudden began to grow ever more important. You are so accustomed to it, you can't even see it as it begins to emerge. The government. Which government? The federal government. Folks, it may turn out in the long run to have been the most important result of the Great Depression. Under FDR, the federal government began to take responsibility for all sorts of things that heretofore had been the responsibility of whom? States or people, like who? You, individuals, and families, and you're, what kind of a class are you in? Religion? Just say churches. Taking care of people. What if everybody needs to be taken care of? Because the federal government has become so overwhelmingly pervasive in our culture, even after the Ronald Reagan revolt against it, we simply cannot see a world in which it played almost no role in daily life at all. For instance, you did not take the federal government into plans about your future and your retirement at all. I mean, at all. What do we do now? Result of the Great Depression. The federal government became, in effect, a rival to organized religion in its role for caring for the ills of society. When Adolf Hitler rose to power in the early and mid-30s, and then began to attack his neighbors in the late 30s. What did the American government do? Almost nothing. Roosevelt tried to do some things through the Congress, but almost nothing. The American public insisted upon isolationism. We're not going to go back over there and get involved in those European wars. We've already done that, been there. Isolationism. What changed it? Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. The first attack on the homeland. Folks, you have lived through the second. And you must have surely some sense of how overwhelmingly important those two airplanes have been in your lives. They changed our world. Period. Everyone in this room can tell me what you were doing when you heard those planes attack. Or when you waked up and heard it. Everyone in the room can. Pearl Harbor. That was the first time that happened. And all of a sudden, it was entirely different. And the nation was galvanized. The attack upon the nation led to what became called the Good War. And as the true extent of the Nazi evil became apparent in and after the war, as the death camps were liberated and the horrors of the crusade against the Jews, the war of extermination against a whole people, the extent to which the good war was a good war became ever more uncontroversial, incontrovertible. And the war solidified the role of the permanent of the government in American life. Folks, what ended the Great Depression? The war, period. Stabilized the economy, and then all of a sudden geared up the economy. Everybody had a job, and here we go. And who directed the fighting of the Great War? The government. All right. With that overview then, I want to begin to talk today and finish on Wednesday to discuss briefly major developments in American religion during our 30-year period. And then focus on the ways in which ideas about Jesus changed during the years of depression and war. The first thing I would like to say is that the period produced a new competitor for Jesus, especially within Protestantism. The period sees the emergence of what I have called God the Book, God the Bible. It sees the emergence of a form of Christianity that is focused primarily not on any of the three members of the Trinity, but on God the Word. God the Book. I refer, of course, to what has come to be called the fundamentalist movement. The fundamentalist movement of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s was part of the conservative reaction in the late 19th and early 20th centuries to the rise of the social gospel, liberalism, and to the efforts to apply what came to be called the higher criticism to the Bible, to situate the Bible in its culture, and to view the Bible as a product of that culture, not as the revealed Word of God. In 1910, this conservative reaction against liberalism and higher criticism came to a head with the publication of a series of pamphlets called The Fundamentals. The Fundamentals were financed by a couple of California wealthy oil men, the Stewart brothers, S-T-E-W-A-R-T. Diamond and Milton, if you're counting. And in the face of all of this higher criticism and of all this literary and cultural critiques of belief, They said, here are the five things that you have to believe to be a true Christian. First of all, you have to believe that the Bible is the literal and inerrant Word of God. That it was inspired literally, verbally by God, and that it speaks inerrantly. It's all true. You have to believe, secondly, in the divinity of Jesus, as exemplified in the miracle of the virgin birth. Number three. What do you think number three would be? Number three. Now, before he gets resurrected, you have to believe, you have to believe that Jesus died for your sins to atone for your sin. The blood atonement of sin for sin of Jesus. None of this. Jesus is the model, social model, ethical model. And then you have to believe in the body resurrection of Jesus. And what do you have to believe? He rose, and he's coming back. When? Soon. In what form? He'll be a spooky thing? No. The bodily, imminent second coming of Jesus. Now, note that four of these five things you have to believe are about Jesus. But also note that the one that gets all the attention is the one that's not about Jesus. It's about the Bible. In the decade after the publication of the pamphlets, conservatives, emboldened by the publication of the Fundamentals, began to mount attacks on liberals in denominational positions of authority throughout Protestantism. They began to purge denominational ranks of liberals, or to try to. They mounted a series of heresy trials, most of which did not succeed, but which did in fact succeed in publicizing the issues at stake.